Good evening, and Tom, thank you for everything you've been doing here, and we are pleased to welcome back to the show Tevi Troy. He is Dr. Tevi Troy. He is a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, the former Deputy Secretary of Health and Human Services in the George W. Bush administration, and a scholar who is everywhere in the conservative press and the non-conservative press. You can read him in Commentary Magazine. You can read him in National Review. And lately, he's been all over the Huffington Post, Politico, and other places. He writes on the culture. He writes on politics. He writes on healthcare. Tevi, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
You have you've been doing a lot of different stuff, and I want to cover it with you because it goes to the heart of this show, politics and culture. I want to start with the politics, though, if I can. You had a piece in Commentary Magazine. It was a symposium back in January. It's a theme we've been covering about what the conservative movement, what the Republican Party needs to do to recapture its mojo. And then about 2 weeks ago at the American Enterprise Institute, you debated this issue, or discussed it at least, with a fellow symposium writer, Pete Wehner, from the Ethics and Public Policy Center. Could you kind of give me an overview of what you wrote in Commentary on this and what your perspective was at that AEI debate?
Yeah, my take on this is that conservatives don't need to abandon their positions, as some people are saying, but they do need to define their positions better. What we had in this last election, unfortunately, and I did support Mitt Romney and worked with his campaign, but you had a candidate who was unable and unwilling to define what kind of conservative he was. And there were a variety of reasons for that. Part of it was his tenure in Massachusetts, and part of it was he just wasn't, let's say, well-read in conservative sources. But he, by not defining a certain vision of conservatism, he allowed others to define him, whether it was Joe Biden or Chris Matthews, or he allowed problematic statements by the Todd Akins of the world to define him. So I argued for a type of conservative as the next standard bearer who would define the movement like a Ronald Reagan did and said, this is what I stand for. And there are other views out there, but they are not necessarily my views. And Reagan, I think, could have dismissed an Akin more effectively than Mitt Romney did. And what you had with Reagan is when you had unsavory people endorse him, he would say, they are signing on to my views. I'm not signing on to theirs.
Yeah, we've seen this this little bit of a battle. I don't know if it's mostly in the Beltway, but people out here and wherever I've traveled have been following it, where there seems to be this anti-establishment notion. Why is the Washington, D.C. establishment picking our candidates for us? Why are they telling us we can't have Christine O'Donnell's and Todd Akins? After all, these are the same people that said we couldn't have Marco Rubio or Mike Lee. What do they know? Let us just pick our people and let the establishment stay out of it. On the other hand, the tension goes, shouldn't there be some adult reasoning, some adult thinking? It's a little more anti-democratic in a sense, that second thought. But on the other hand, it's hard to say that we couldn't have won some seats had we had some adult thinking on some of those primaries.
Five seats, to be specific.
Yeah.
I mean, there are five Senate seats that polls indicated would have gone for Republicans if they had not had some of the more problematic candidates over the last two election cycles. And those five, when you add it to the current 45, would leave us with basically a majority or half the U.S. Senate right now.
Half the U.S. Senate. Yeah, let's keep that in mind. Let's definitely keep that in mind. One wonders what they would have done with a Ronald Reagan, because, you know, something I've pointed out to the listeners here is today everyone, you know, worships at the altar of Ronald Reagan, appropriately so. It wasn't so in 1979 and 1980. Even people who latched on to his star, you know, latched on a little after the fact. George Will, who was known to be a great friend of Reagan's and drove around in the limo with Nancy Reagan, he was a Howard Baker guy in 79-80 during the primaries.
Right.
William F. Buckley Jr., I came to learn, also this supposed great friend of Ronald Reagan's, longtime Reagan booster, he was supporting George H.W. Bush until it became clear that Ronald Reagan was going to be the man. So it's not as if the intellectual grassroots or the movement is always coalescing around the right guy either.
Yeah, this is a point I actually made in the debate, which is people act as if the conservative movement was all happy together back in 1980 and
right.
that the roiling tensions of today
it was
are a
not.
New phenomenon. It wasn't a ladies' tea party
no.
back in 1980.
No.
I mean, there were very bitter divides that not only took place before the election, but within the Reagan White House. There was the Baker team and the Meese team, and those they were bitter enemies even inside the White House.
Oh, I know. You can talk to Bill Bennett and get some of those stories. I know you have, and our listeners can hear some of those stories from 3 to 6 a.m. here Monday through Thursday, or 4 to 7 other times of the year. But Tevi, so bring us up to today. Different perspectives. The party needs to change. It needs to change its message, or does it need to change its messaging? Does it need to change its content, or does it need to change its delivery? You wrote at one point that someone like well, go ahead and answer that question. We'll come back to my follow-up.
Yeah, I'm not one of these people who says that all issues are set in stone and you can never make changes or adjustments. In fact, the three biggest issues that Reagan pushed were lowering federal income tax rates, strong stance against the Soviet Union, and a strong anti-crime stance. Now, those are somewhat overtaken by events because a lot of Americans don't pay federal income taxes and the rates are now lower. The Soviet Union is obviously defeated, and crime, we abhor crime and we want a tough stance on it, but it's not the problem in the U.S. that it was in 1980 when it seemed like crime was going out of control. So just because those three issues are no longer as resonant with the American people doesn't mean we abandon those positions. We're still for lower taxes, but we have to change the issue mix. We promote other issues that are still conservative issues and highlight them because I think those resonate with voters more now.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, another thing that was pretty popular, if memory serves, in 1980 in the Reagan arsenal was the issue of welfare. You know, the way he spoke about welfare seemed to attract, it was one of the few things that seemed to attract what we used to call Reagan Democrats or lunch pail voters, wasn't it? And that goes directly to your point of where we are today with so many people not paying income taxes, so many more people on some form of welfare.
Yeah, I mean, there was that urban ethnic coalition, the Ed Koch Democrats, if you will.
Yeah.
The people who kind of wanted to have a tougher stance on foreign policy issues, were sick and tired of crime, were worried about the social issues, but weren't necessarily Republicans on economic issues. And they went along with Ronald Reagan, and Ronald Reagan had a pretty healthy attitude about this. As somebody who is with me 80% of the time is not my enemy because we're in opposition 20%, but they're 80% an ally. And so he was willing to work with people who had slightly different perspectives but who were trying to share a larger goal.
All right, so with all due respect, Tevi, and this is unfair because we're going into the break on this point, but you can think on it, you can stew on it, you can curse me out over the break, and we'll come back to it. With all due respect to our candidate, he did two things Reagan would have never done on this sort of issue, right? He would not have written off a large percentage of the electorate and said so, right? And Reagan would not have ever had to say, I'm severely conservative. He didn't talk about his conservatism. He talked about his vision, and it got labeled conservative. I want to come back to that because it presages how we campaign in the future. We'll be right back with more from Tevi Troy.
You're listening to Arizona Politics and Culture, the place for intelligent dialogue in the Valley. Make sure to send us an email, communicate with us, request Seth's monologue, or links to podcasts of the show, apcpatriot@gmail.com. That's apcpatriot@gmail.com.
Talking to Tevi Troy, Dr. Tevi Troy, senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, one of the nation's premier public intellectuals. Always a pleasure to have him with us. Tevi, we're talking about a debate you had recently, both in the pages of Commentary Magazine and orally at the American Enterprise Institute, about what the conservative movement and Republican Party needs to do to recapture its strength. And before we went to break, we were talking about the way Reagan used to talk and attract people with a conservative message versus other candidates of recent note who try to wear their conservatism on a sleeve and also try to thread some kind of needle to appeal to the independent or the moderate. What did he get right, Reagan, that our guys don't? now?
Well, I think Reagan tried to talk to everybody. He didn't try and write off certain parts of the population. I think he was conservative and embraced a conservative vision, but I don't think he talked about it as saying, I am a conservative. Right. He said, I'm an American, we have shared values. Where he talked about America as a shining city on the hill. And one thing I argued in the debate with Pete Wehner is that I don't think Republicans do well if they try and break America up into different demographic groups and you need X percent of the black vote and Y percent of the white vote and Z percent of the Hispanic vote. I think Reagan succeeded and Republicans will succeed if they try and aspire to a larger vision of what makes us all united as Americans. And I think that's a very powerful thing. I don't think every candidate can do it, and some candidates, like Obama, kind of specialize in the breaking up into demographic groups. But I don't think that's a winning strategy for Republicans.
It is a Democratic strategy, has been for a long time. I have always thought that you're right. You're exactly right. You talk about America, you talk about Americans, and you talk about your vision, and you don't worry about putting a label on it. And somehow, if you're sincere, you know, there's an old saying that words that come from the heart enter the heart. I think that Reagan was the best at it. I think the second best at it, Rich Lowry had a piece in Politico on this recently, this past week. The second best at it was Jack Kemp. They did this very, very well, and they never had to announce that they were conservative. They never had to announce, really, that they were Republicans. What they did was they talked about Lincoln. They talked about their patriotism. They talked about America. They talked about opportunity for all Americans. They talked about the American dream. And then there was something else Reagan did, maybe less so Kemp, although I have to think about it, in 1980. And I want to remind people of this, too. With all the issues of the misery index and the gas lines and the high inflation and all and the energy crisis, all these domestic issues, I don't think, in my reading, there was a speech Ronald Reagan gave in 1979 or 1980 that didn't address foreign policy, that didn't address defense policy. He integrated it into everything he said and did. And things are not easier for America on the foreign policy stage now, even though the Soviet Union is gone. If anything, they're more complex and possibly more dangerous. But our candidates tend to shrink from it. They kind of feel like they get their fingers burned when they touch it.
Well, I think part of the problem is there's a kind of hangover from the Iraq War, and a lot of Republicans are just reluctant to even talk about foreign policy right now. One of the hallmarks of Republican foreign policy has been a more aggressive U.S. stance abroad. And with the sense of exhaustion, I think, that we have post the Iraq and also the Afghanistan war, I think that's why there's some of this reluctance.
Okay, here's your next piece. You got to write it. It just dawned on me, Tevi. We're talking to Tevi Troy. Here's your next piece. I don't think the Iraq war in the popular mind was as unpopular as the Vietnam War in the popular mind come 1979. And Ronald Reagan gave the Vietnam veterans something to believe in and fight in, and the country something to believe in and fight for, right? So, people may have had their fingers burnt over Vietnam, too. But somehow Reagan overcame it in a big way. And, you have all these images of veterans around Reagan throughout some of his greatest moments and greatest speeches. And he overcame that, and he got us through the Vietnam syndrome after all, right? Gosh, I wish we could have a Republican that could get us through the Iraq War syndrome without thinking that the way to do that is to weaken our defenses or security.
But Seth, there's a major difference
here. Okay.
And Bob Dole referred to it in the 1976 debate, vice presidential debate, when he called them Democrat wars. The wars, the Vietnam War and wars preceding it, were seen as wars that had been started under Democratic control.
Oh, Tevi, is that really true, though? I mean, today we know that factually, sure, it was Lyndon Johnson's war. Hey, LBJ, I'm doing this to you again. I'm going into the break on this strong point, okay? But it was seen as Nixon's thing more than anything, wasn't it? Think on it. We'll be right back. More with Tevi Troy on the other side of Arizona Politics and Culture here with me and Tommy Brown.
You're listening to Arizona Politics and Culture, and we would love to hear from you. You can send us an email, apcpatriot@gmail.com. That's apcpatriot@gmail.com. We'll be right back.
Tevi Troy joins us again. He is the senior fellow at the Hudson Institute and one of the nation's great great conservative public intellectuals. Sounds like I push on him a little bit. I really don't mean to. I want to make this on the record that my entire career I owe to Tevi Troy. He, for those who hate me or like me, you can blame him. He brought me to Washington, D.C. way back when I was just a little kid in my salad days and got me my first job and my second and my third and my fourth. So all credit to Tevi Troy or all hatred towards him, depending on how you think I'm doing.
I'm expecting a lot of hate tweets.
Yeah, you'll get some. You'll get some. Tevi, we were talking about Republicans not talking enough about foreign and defense policy, and there's this Iraq War syndrome that may be partly to blame. I was contrasting it with what I thought was the Vietnam syndrome in 79-80, which I thought was worse, but Reagan overcame. Peggy Noonan, indeed, a Reagan alum, if any is a Reagan alum, Peggy Noonan is a Reagan alum, had a piece in the Wall Street Journal this weekend saying how the Iraq War, in fact, ruined the Republican Party. I take your point that the Vietnam War was, you know, a JFK, LBJ thing, but it was also very much a Nixon thing and a Ford thing, more Nixon than Ford, and seen as, for better or worse, right, it was seen as the kind of thing conservatives and Republicans supported, and less so Democrats over time, especially over the last 5 years of the Vietnam War.
Look, there was shared blame to go around, sure. And back then we did have a more bipartisan foreign policy, the statement that foreign policy stops at the water's edge or partisanship stops at the water's edge had more meaning back then. So and there was also less geographical unity in the country. You didn't have red states and blue states to the same degree. So you had liberal Republicans in New York and conservative Democrats in the South. So it was a very different time. So we just have to stipulate that. But I do think that the Vietnam War hung over the Democrats for a very long time, and they were very wary of getting burned on it again. And Republicans saw it as an opportunity and a political opportunity. But also, they were in the right on the policy that you needed to have a more aggressive stance, especially against the Soviet Union. And I served in the Bush administration, and I agreed that they needed to take an aggressive stance on the war on terror. In fact, I can remember dozens of people, Democrats, saying to me, "Boy, I'm glad Al Gore is not president now, because you remember the close Florida contested issue of 2000. So I don't think Republicans should shy away from an aggressive foreign policy, but I do recognize that it's politically a little more dicey now because of Iraq and Afghanistan.
All right, good. Listen, I want people to read everything you write on all this stuff, so you can do it by going to, is it tevitroy.com?
Org. Tevitroy.org.
Okay, you're a nonprofit. Tevitroy.org. You didn't start that way. That's just how it ended up, right? Okay. That's what this dry cleaners I used to work for in town. Pride Cleaners, my first job. They had a sign there that said, "We are a nonprofit. We didn't start that way. That's just how it worked out." Tevitroy.org. TEVITROY.org. Tevi, people Google you. If they were to Google you in the news, they would find a slew of links to a piece you just did on the Republican Party and the culture. Huffington Post picked it up, Politico, it seems like everyone. Because this past week, the Republican Party put out a coming to terms, a new strategy, a new
autopsy.
Blueprint, a new autopsy, as you call it. They call it the Growth and Opportunity Project. Sure, Growth and Opportunity, I'm for that. Wasn't that the Steve Forbes campaign, Hope, Growth, and Opportunity?
Yeah.
It was a good one. I think it was very Kempian. Jack Kempian, Growth and Opportunity. I like
that. Of course,
that.
Neither of them became president.
Neither of them became president. But okay. Another pop culture. I'm trying to get us there. Okay, so you wrote this piece because part of their document, part of their autopsy was about how to appeal in the pop culture. Go ahead and say a word or two on that.
Well, first of all, I'm writing a book on this that's coming out in September. It's about a history of presidents and pop culture and how they've engaged with the culture, whether it's books or television or movies or theater or even today tweeting. So that's what had me thinking about this. And the book's coming out in September. But right now you have the RNC putting out this autopsy or report where they specifically talk about how they need to improve their pop culture efforts. And President Obama, and I talked about this in the piece, brilliantly used pop culture. He didn't meet with David Gregory during the campaign. He went on local DJ radios. He went on The View. He engaged in entertainment media and was very up to date on TV shows, on movies, on songs. He talked about Carly Rae Jepsen's song on one of the interviews. So he knew what he was talking about in terms of pop culture, and that really helped him connect with young people. And young people not only came out strong for Obama, but they voted overwhelmingly in favor of Obama because he seemed to relate to them. Now, Mitt Romney, I also talk about in the piece, he had his pop culture references as well, but they were references to Seinfeld and Ferris Bueller's Day Off, which I know resonate with you and me, Seth.
30-year-old movie. It's a
30-year-old
movie.
They don't appeal to the current generation.
Right? The movie is almost 30 years old.
Right. This is your dad's pop culture, not your pop culture.
Right.
And so Obama was able to show that he was very up-to-date and hip, and he appealed. And so I argue that Republicans need to rethink how they engage with pop culture. And it's not a strategy you can just apply from above. You can't say, okay, we're going to be pop culture. You need somebody who actually lives it and breathes it. And President Obama, for all his flaws, really understands our pop culture.
Right. He really does. And I'm just trying to sit and sit back and think a little bit about our most recent primary, the 2011-2012 GOP primary, about who of the candidates may have understood it the best. Maybe Tim Pawlenty seemed to be plugged into it a little more.
My opinion is Huckabee.
Maybe
even as a Southern Baptist preacher of those that were in early on.
Yeah.
And he's still the most active of all of them that are out there.
And a musician, but he didn't run.
But the bottom line is Republicans just in general are not as up to date when it comes to pop culture. And oftentimes it's because pop culture is sending out messages that are patently offensive to Republicans.
Well, that does kind of take us back to our first issue of writing off things, right? We write off California, but we also write off Hollywood totally and fully.
Right. So, I mean, it's just a dumb example. In the movie The Three Stooges, which, full confession, I didn't see, one of the characters was a bad guy. It was Sofia Vergara. And they showed she was a bad guy because she was reading the Weekly Standard in bed.
Okay, so
there's no reason to alienate half the population by making that joke, but they figured that Republicans don't care or don't attend or whatever. So,
and wasn't George Bush's head on a stake in Game of Thrones? I think so.
Yes, it was.
Yeah, so
talk about that in the book as well.
Right. So, I mean, they take us on, but, you know, we should not write them off. And here's one reason I say that. As not too far back as 2004, I don't know if you remember this event. It was, I think, a very telling moment of the Bush-Kerry campaign in 2004 when John Kerry did a fundraiser at Radio City Music Hall, and it was all the Hollywood glitterati, you know? And at the end, Whoopi Goldberg gave a talk that just was, to call it blue is to underrate how caustic it was. And then John Kerry said, thank you. You have shown us Hollywood's values once again.
Yes, I remember
Hollywood's values are America's values. That's what he said. America said something else. And by the way, so did some of Whoopi Goldberg's sponsors. I think Weight Watchers dropped her as a result. But, Hollywood is not America.
Right. And even when Republicans like the same shows as Democrats, when you have Obama said he liked Modern Family, and the Modern Family cast does a fundraiser for Obama.
Right.
But when Mrs. Romney said that she liked to watch Modern Family, there was a nasty tweet about gay marriage that was sent out by the creator of Modern Family. So the Hollywood people don't like to engage with the Republicans. And you know, there's that famous story of every time Republicans have a song for the guy to come out on stage, if it's a Democrat who wrote the song, which it usually is, they withdraw the permission. And there's one guy who joked that the only kind of songs that Republicans can use are by country stars or dead people.
Sort of. I have a story on that. Sort of. Sometimes they lose their nerve. I can tell you about a very well-known country music star who did not want to be, who you would have thought was a Republican, who did not want to be associated with the Republican convention at all. But you're right. You're absolutely right. Nonetheless, country music is still the most widely played music in the country. So, I mean, we could do worse than to have, you know, our Martina McBrides. We really could do worse. But not all of country music is Democrat, and not all this is Republican, and not all the South is either. I get that.
Look, this has been going on for years.
It's been going on for
Richard
years.
Richard Nixon, I talk about this in my book, brought Merle Haggard to the White House because of the Okie from Muskogee song.
Yep.
And he thought that showed Republican values. And, you know, Haggard subsequently endorsed Bill Clinton. So, I mean, it's not like he's a big Republican. But there was this feeling that country's values seem to resonate or correspond to Republican values.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think there is this view of that. But, you know, even if country music aside, we just cannot write off the pop culture at all, and we can't be citing 30-year-old movies. We just cannot be doing it. How do we go about reengaging in the pop culture and grabbing the youth vote and showing them that we're hip, we're cool, we're with it, cares about my concerns, as the phrase is now taking on such great status? I just think be in it. I don't think it's that hard. I really don't. As Tommy said here, you know, Mike Huckabee does a pretty good job of it. Others do too. Gosh, he's not my guy, but Donald Trump seems to, you know, as an old white guy, you know, he seems to engage in the pop culture pretty well.
Bill Clinton did it great.
Yeah. I mean, you're right. And you brought in, I mean, didn't you bring in some stars when you were in the Bush White House? I mean, I don't know that they were Bush supporters, but you tried. I say just keep trying. Just keep trying.
I remember we sat down with Dr. Phil and talked to him about his policy ideas.
Yeah, right. Dr. Phil, I think you even had someone from Wisteria Lane, didn't you?
Oh, that's right. She's actually a big Democrat, was a co-chair of the Obama campaign.
All right,
she
you can brag.
She was cousins with one of my colleagues on the Domestic Policy Council.
You can brag. Tell it.
Ava Longoria.
You met with Ava Longoria.
I met her at the White House mess, and she is probably the most beautiful woman I've ever met in person.
Okay, after your wife. Sure. I can understand that. I totally can. But we need to be doing that, and we need to show them that we do have things in common. I mean, there's Gerard Depardieu, right? Someone like that in France, we can make an alliance with. We can do better than Clint Eastwood. We just can't.
Well, Bruce Willis is kind of libertarian leanings. I mean, there are conservative stars in Hollywood, but they tend to downplay it because it actually hurts their ability to get jobs.
That's the great shame for all the talk we hear about McCarthyism still whenever George Clooney gets on a microphone to talk about Hollywood. What they don't understand or what they seem to want to neglect or ignore is that if you have a somewhat center-right point of view in Hollywood, you're not going to have much of a career. You're just not. There's a few who are bold enough to stand out. Gary Oldman may be one of them. I guess Clint Eastwood maybe, but... You know, there's just not a lot of A-listers.
Patricia Heaton.
Right, but I mean, she's not an A-lister, really.
Really not anymore. Yeah, not anymore. Had that opportunity. One wonders if there's a...
Right, I mean, can you imagine what her career would have been if she hadn't been Republican? She might have been a much bigger star because she was on a very successful sitcom for a long time.
Yeah, no, that's right. No, that's right. But, you know, we need to do a better job of this. And I'm glad you're on the case and you're the right one to be writing about it and talking about it and encouraging it, Tevi. So much more to do. What I want to do is have you back, Tevi, to talk about books. We used to do a book segment together. This is a literate audience. People like books. It's a part of our culture. So in a couple weeks, can I come back and start up the book review with Tevi Troy once again?
Always happy to do it.
That would be great.
What are you reading right now?
Yeah, what are you reading?
Right now, I'm reading The Oath by Jeffrey Toobin.
Yeah.
It's a book about the interaction between the Roberts Supreme Court and Obama. You know, Obama came out against John Roberts in his confirmation hearing, even though Roberts was a relatively uncontroversial person. And so there's some tension between them because of that. And then The Oath refers to the fact that Roberts kind of messed up the oath when Obama was sworn in, and they had to do the oath a second time. Interestingly, Obama had to do his oath two times this time around, so he's the only president besides Franklin Roosevelt who's taken the oath of office four times, so it's for only two terms. But it's got a lot of great backstory stuff about what's going on under the robes, as it were, at the Supreme Court.
Tevi Troy, senior fellow Hudson Institute, former Deputy Secretary of Health and Human Services, great public and intellectual, author, writer. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first hour in the books. And, you know, we haven't even talked about our week yet, so we got to get to that. I had a great day on Thursday, as a matter of fact, and, well, we just got to talk about it. That's part of our pop culture, right? You can interact with the show, apcpatriot@gmail.com. Send us an email, request Seth Monologue or the podcast links, apcpatriot@gmail.com.